God bless the United States and this honorable court. You may be seated.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Judge Castle. To my right is Judge Mormon. To my left is Judge Davis. We're here today in the matter of Simmons versus Shinsefke, docket number 031731. Would counsel for both parties please note their appearance for the record?
Sean Raven for Ms. Patricia Simmons with Kathy Lieberman and Mr. Michael Kerman.
All right, thank you.
Yvette White for the Secretary, along with Dave Patsy, Deputy Secretary General Counsel for the Secretary.
All right, thank you very much. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present their respective arguments. Before we get going, though, is there any issue with regard to the right ear hearing loss? Helen says no.
Your Honor, we say no.
Yes, Your Honor.
You are going to contest. You're going to.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're going to make argument on that. Okay. All right, Mr. Raven, you can go first. You reserve time.
Yes, Your Honor. 10 minutes, please, reserve.
10 minutes will be reserved, and please, you may sit. If you have any discussion on the right ear hearing loss, can you go with that first and then separate into the left ear hearing loss?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court. It's our contention that the only issue before the Court is currently the allocation of the burden of prejudice with regards to type 1 notice errors. With regards to the right ear hearing loss, in their briefs filed with at the Federal Circuit, the Secretary clearly indicated that they were not challenging that portion of the Veterans Court order that dealt with the right ear hearing loss. On page 4 of the Secretary's brief to the Fed Circuit, page 3 and 4, in footnote 2, the Secretary wrote, "Respondent appellant does not appeal that portion of the Veterans Court decision." And in the reply brief, the Secretary's counsel wrote, "The portions of the Veterans Court's order that we do not challenge pertaining to the adequacy of the Board's statement of reasons or basis for its findings and the regional office's compliance with the terms of the Board's prior remand order are wholly distinct from the issue of whether the claimant was prejudiced by VA's error providing notice under Section 5103F. As stated in Demetrius, our determination not to challenge those portions of the Veterans Court remand order does not change the nature of the portions the government does challenge. For these reasons, we believe that the issue of entitlement to service connection for the right ear hearing loss is not properly before the Court."
Do you know, do you recall, or do you have, is that an iPad? What is it?
Yes, it is, sir.
Do you have on there the Federal Circuit's decision, whether or not they, how, what their order was to the Court?
The Federal, I do have it on here, but I believe it would be faster possibly to get it.
From the old paperwork?
We're still experimenting with this.
No, I love it. I have one myself.
Right. We have the complete record on here, but with regards to the Court's decision, I believe the Federal Circuit said the only issue that they were going to rule on was going to be the notice issue, if I recall correctly, unless you'd like to draw my attention specifically to anything there.
No, I'd rather you draw my attention.
By the way, I have a Kindle. I'd like to talk to you about how they compare at some point.
Okay. I'll be glad to afterwards, Ronald.
Okay.
I believe that in the decision, it clearly stated that they were only discussing the issue of error, and they didn't discuss waiver.
Why don't we do this? Let your co-counsel take a look at that.
Okay.
And you, do you have anything else on right ear hearing loss?
Your Honor, we would just say that based on DAV versus Gober and the Federal Rules of Appellate Litigation, Federal Rules of Appellate Practice, that by waiving this issue in their initial brief and by clearly stating explicitly that they're not challenging that part of the order, that order is not before the Court, part of the order.
Would it be fair to say that if we ever got beyond that, that you stand by the single judge decision that remanded that part?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. You want to move into left ear?
Your Honor, the Secretary should bear the burden of demonstrating that no prejudice resulted from a Type 1 notice error.
All right, let me, and I don't know if the other judges are on this or not, but for my purposes here, given the Federal Circuit's decision in VF, What is the notice that has to be given? What's the general notice that has to be given for an increased rating claim?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Given the
Federal Circuit's decision in Vasquez Flores, yeah. Isn't it not just worsening?
In Vasquez, yes.
Okay, so the notice has to be basically that your situation is worsening. Show us how it's worsening.
That's it.
Okay. Accepting that the notice given here applied only to the right ear and therefore is defective with regard to... Right. Sorry.
Yes, it was only with regards to the right ear. The
right.
Left ear is the
and defective ear. With regard to the left ear.
Right.
Assuming Mayfield 1 still lives, and assuming Mayfield 1, which was a service connection case, applies to an increased rating case, assume all that.
Okay.
Address the Secretary's position that your client was not prejudiced.
First, I believe that Judge Davis's finding in his memorandum decision that there was a notice error still stands because, as a factual finding, that finding can't be challenged at the Federal Circuit. Federal Circuit doesn't have jurisdiction over findings of fact, only interpretations of law.
No, I said accept that.
Okay.
I'm just trying to cut this down.
Certainly. With regards to the Secretary's position, the Secretary's position would generally go to whether or not this court has the authority to make empirically based, non-binding generalizations about the natural effects of deficient type 1 notice.
Well, let me get beyond that. Let's assume that all applies.
Okay.
I'm still, here's what got me. I think somewhere in your brief she said that Jesus, she'd only known, she'd only been given the notice, she would have submitted a doctor's statement. And when I go through the record, I see at 198 a doctor's statement. I see at 201 a statement from a relative.
Sure.
I also see a July 01 VA medical examination, audiological, and an August 02 audiological. So just to be honest, as I'm sitting here looking at your brief, I'm going, what are you guys talking about?
Sure.
Okay.
The Secretary's argument is basically that Mrs. Simmons had actual knowledge of the information evidence necessary to substantiate her claim. And the way that I would argue against that would be that Mrs. Simmons basically threw everything she had at the Secretary, but she was never fully informed of the evidence, information evidence necessary to substantiate her claim.
But what? Okay, so she was told it was worsening. And before we go there, you can also address that throughout this record, from 83, she was told worsening, and I'll say that doesn't bind her with this particular claim because it's a subsequent one. She appealed to the board in 89, pointing out that her condition had worsened.
Right.
She then submitted her own doctor statement after the remand by the board in 01, and then two VA doctor statements. So that's, in that context, I'm having a hard time.
Sure.
You.
Well, in a sense, if notice in a general sense is whether or not a condition has worsened, then you could say that every veteran has actual knowledge by simply filing a claim for increased disability rating based on a worsening condition.
Well, just so you know, I've had that discussion with my clerks.
Okay.
Because go back to what I said. Assuming that this all applies to an increased rating claim, after VF came out from the Federal Circuit, you're left with just basically a worsening. If you're applying for an increased benefits, how are you going to get prejudice out of that?
Well, you can still find a Type 1 notice error if they, for example, provide information and evidence on how to establish service connection rather than worsening. But in Vasquez Flores, Ms. Lieberman is counsel in Vasquez Flores. But as this just so happens,
right.
We didn't plan it. And as it happens, this applies actually to the affirmative, to the rebuttal from the Secretary about actual knowledge. I don't believe Vasquez Flores applies to actual knowledge. There's a difference between actual knowledge of the information and evidence necessary to substantiate a claim versus proper notice, whether or not there's deficient notice. And that's how
Well, I think we had deficient notice. I said accept that.
Right. But then the Secretary's argument is that, well, the burden shifts to us. However, we would show that Ms. Simmons has
I think the appellant. I think the Secretary came back and did an alternative argument that said, no, the record demonstrates prejudice and cites to a bunch of stuff that I've kind of summarized here to indicate no prejudice. So it wasn't just left on a burden. You know, you have to demonstrate that there was prejudice. I think they've come back and tried to show that there's no prejudice, and I'm trying to get from you why there's no prejudice.
Why there is prejudice. The reason why there is prejudice is because it's extremely confusing. The reason why there is prejudice is because if she had been given that information and evidence, as she stated in her affidavit, she would have gone to the doctor, as Judge Davis indicated in his single-judge decision, and asked for a specific medical opinion. I've had a stependectomy in my left ear. There's a chance it will improve, but there's also a chance that it will go south and I will lose hearing in my left ear. Can you write a medical opinion letter indicating what the current condition of my ear is?
But how would that get a higher rating? I mean, she got a rating. She's service-connected. It's a 0% disability rating because it doesn't rise to those levels. She submitted her own doctor's report on that. Even if the doctor said what you said, how do you get a higher rating?
You get a higher rating because she actually went deaf in her left ear. She's legally deaf now in her left ear.
Well, at the time, I mean...
At the time, well, right at the tail end, and in my supplemental brief, I alluded to this, right at the tail end of the record, there's a citation that indicates, oh, Ms. Simmons has just undergone an operation in November of 2002.
This is your reference to R-279?
I believe it is, sir.
That's the page from the doctor's medical report that says audiogram performed post-surgery. Patient long-standing hearing aid user, etc.
That's correct, John.
Okay.
It's after the step...
So build on that, and I think this builds on Judge Castle's question. You know, why does that demonstrate that there was prejudice here?
Had she been given the proper notice with information and evidence, she would be able to effectively participate in the proceedings by going back to the doctor and saying, look, this is what I need in order to get a compensable disability rating for my hearing loss. Is my left ear hearing loss to a degree that it meets those standards, that meets that criteria, the mechanical application of the law? And intertwined with this is also the right ear. If the right ear is service-connected and it's significantly impaired, it's moderately impaired, and now it's actually, as she states in her affidavit, she now has hearing loss in the right ear too. If that's service-connected, then hearing loss in a mechanical application table, its compensation would go up. So, given the proper notice, if she really fully understood, she could...
Just to be clear, none of the notice would say anything about the rating schedules because the Federal Circuit said you don't need that anymore, so all you need is a worsening.
Okay, I got it.
With worsening, it's a real puzzle that's really difficult to say, other than saying she would have gone back to her doctor and said, look, I need to show that it's worsening. Under Vasquez Flores, if that's the only type of notice provided, and it's supposed to tell a person, a claimant, what type of information and evidence they need to demonstrate that they're entitled to a compensable rating, it would be very difficult for Mrs. Simmons to say specifically to her doctor, I need a medical opinion that shows worsening, but to tell you the truth, I don't know exactly what I need to show, just that my condition's worse. But go ahead and evaluate it and tell me what the prognosis is for future, whether the stependectomy has a likelihood of becoming worse and causing me to suffer left ear hearing loss completely, and I go deaf.
Right, but if it did worse than accepting that it did, you could file another claim.
She could. She could, or she get a staged rating. I don't believe that Mayfield was in any way dismantled or reversed by the Supreme Court's decision in Shinseki versus Sanders.
Right. If we accept that, can you take the next level? Why does it apply to an increased rating claim? Given the notice is so general, it basically says worsening condition, which you've even indicated anyone who applies for an increased rating probably presumptively has.
Right. But again, in Ms. Simmons' case, she wasn't given information about a worsening condition. She was given information about how to establish service connection. That's what makes this case maybe unique in the type 1 notice error that there is. It's that all they had to do was provide her with...
But the question was, how does Mayfield 1, a service connection case, apply, accepting the presumption burdens, et cetera, in Mayfield 1, how does that apply to an increased rating claim? Like, you got bad notice.
Yeah.
Okay, you got no notice. Well, I mean, right. Accept that just for discussion purposes.
Sure. Then for
so the how does the burden shift, though? I mean, how does the burden shift to the secretary to prove you weren't prejudiced, if you want to talk about burdens? How does Mayfield 1 apply in an increased rating claim?
The secretary would have to demonstrate the essential fairness adjudication.
But why? If an appellant knows they're seeking increased rating and because it worsened.
Because I don't think Vasquez Flores applies specifically to actual knowledge. I think they're different issues. There's a distinction between proper notice and demonstrating actual.
You want to ask your counsel if Ms. Flores had actual knowledge in it? Because while she may have been the counsel, I think I wrote the one from here.
I think you've been on the panel for almost every single one of the notice errors.
No, not all.
Almost.
But anyway.
Okay.
All right, I get it. I'm okay. I don't know.
I have nothing further.
Thank you. And you do have reserve time of 10 minutes. Ms. White, would you discuss your position with regard to the left ear, directly addressing counsel's position and the cites that he gave from the secretary's brief to the Federal Circuit, or from the government's brief to the Federal Circuit?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're allowed to change your position.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
You're allowed to change the position you presented at first, at least from this perspective.
In terms of the right ear hearing loss, Your Honor?
In terms of the right ear hearing loss.
Your Honor, we're going to stand by the position that the right ear hearing loss is applicable in this case unless counsel is willing to waive that issue. We truly believe that in terms of the right ear hearing loss, the Supreme Court remanded that particular issue in terms of the service, in terms of the decision that was remanded from the Veterans Court. We specifically, in the reconsideration, discussed that specific issue, and we think that that issue should be relooked at because we believe that the court did not take into consideration that this issue was not raised in the appellant's initial brief.
Can you point the court to some place in the Supreme Court's decision in Sanders where they mentioned the right ear?
Well, Your Honor,
I may have skipped over it. I just.
In the final analysis, Your Honor, it talks about what occurred with the right ear hearing loss.
How about a page number, counsel?
If Your Honor would give me a moment to look at.
I think I see a reference to it in subpart E. That's a factual, but that's a factual recitation. Like.
Your Honor, when the court is talking of.
Well, also on 1708, near the bottom of the majority decision, they do note VA scheduled further examination of the right ear. That might have revealed further left ear hearing loss, though. So your position is that the Supreme Court, well, let me ask you this. Do you agree with counsel in his reading of your briefs, of the government's briefs in the Federal Circuit, that you did not raise this issue and did not bring it to appeal to the Federal Circuit?
Your Honor, counsel would need to look closer at the specific.
All right. If they are correct, is it your position that the Supreme Court reached down, grabbed this issue, and nevertheless decided it? Or if they are correct, do you concede that it was not on appeal to the Supreme Court?
Your Honor, we would still need to, I think, if the counsel would like to take a look at that particular issue.
All right, well, maybe your co-counsel can look at it while you discuss the other, unless you have further questions on this one.
No, I don't.
Why don't we try and come back to that, if you get speedy assistance there.
Okay. Your Honor, could you just reapprise me one term when
Do you agree with your opposing counsel with the reading that he gave us from the briefs that were submitted to the Federal Circuit that you were not appealing the issue of the right ear hearing loss.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I thought we were going into the left ear hearing.
Oh, no. Yeah, no. I thought you were asking me to repeat the issues on the right ear.
No, Your Honor.
Well, the issues on the left ear are addressed to counsel.
We're clear that if that decision is, in terms of the right ear hearing loss, Judge Castle, that the issue is a lie, that Carbino v. West should have been applied in that particular situation, especially where appellant in his brief to the court initially in the facts section cites specifically that she did not receive a hearing examination, and it was denied, and appellant did not raise that issue to its reply brief until its reply brief, and it worked an unfair practice to the secretary in terms of decision on this case.
Let's assume that on review the court determines that the issue with regard to the right ear is not before the court, and that the decision of Judge Davis with regard to the right ear being remanded stands. What would be the government's position with regard to whether or not the right ear and the left ear are inextricably intertwined?
Your Honor, in terms of the determination as to that issue standing, the court, I think, recently made a determination in Tyrus v. Shinseki that, in terms of the concept of inextricably intertwined, that in order to decide one issue, you would not necessarily have to remand the other.
I think that's fair in part. I think what we actually said in Tyrus was, to fill it out, that the court had jurisdiction to consider the issue of inextricable intertwination, whether or not there was a final decision by the board as to one of the issues. And then the court, in exercising its discretion and the traditional concepts with regard to what is and isn't inextricably intertwined, would apply its judgment as to whether or not the case properly before it ought to be sent back down to await a decision by the board as to that which is inextricably intertwined. It's a little bit different than what you're saying. In other words, in my view, what Tyrus says is court has jurisdiction over a final decision of the board, even if it's remanded a portion of the claim. And the court will then make the determination as to whether or not the two are inextricably intertwined, if that's raised, or if the court sees a need to do so for purposes of judicial economy, among other things. Well, so if I'm correct as to what Tyrus means, would you comment on what the government's position is on whether or not the right ear and left ear are inextricably intertwined?
Yes, Your Honor. The Secretary would have to concede that the issues would be inextricably intertwined in this particular case, and the Secretary would ask that the court remand this case based upon Majeed, since appellant raised this issue for the first time on appeal in the in his brief. As to the Secretary's position in terms of whether or not the appellant should have the burden of pleading prejudice, the Secretary believes that pursuant to the Supreme Court's decision in Kentucky v. Sanders, that it was clear that the Supreme Court stated that the burden pursuant to Palmer v. Hoffman should be on the appellant regardless of the circumstances. And recently, the Federal Circuit in Hite v. Kentucky has applied that in its case, where it specifically stated that the burden to argue prejudice as well as to demonstrate prejudice is on the appellant.
Counsel, are we not bound by the Mayfield paradigm then? That seems to me your logical conclusion is that we, as this panel, need not follow Mayfield.
Your Honor, what the Secretary is saying is that there has been a change in the ruling of the law since the Supreme Court's decision. Since the time that Mayfield was instituted, at the time that Mayfield was decided, there was no specific parameters that were put into existence until the Supreme Court's decision. Now that the Supreme Court has made its decision, it has made a determination as to what the requirements are that would be inconsistent with the Veterans Court's requirement to take the due account of rule of prejudicial error. So therefore, in making a new decision in terms of what the Supreme Court stated, the court in deciding what should be appropriate in terms of a type 1 notice error, the court should look at the rationale as supplied by the Supreme Court, that if you're going to make mandatory presumptions, that speaks against it goes counter to the rule of harmless error. Therefore, if it runs counter to the rule of harmless error, although Mayfield has been decided in terms of the automatic presumptions that the court instituted with the type 1 notice error, in a sense, the Supreme Court says that it's inconsistent with 38 U.S.C. Section 7261 B2.
But the Supreme Court limited that to binding presumptions, did it not?
Actually, Your Honor, when looking at the decision of the Supreme Court said that it would be decisions that, in essence, really going to the natural effects, wouldn't be indeed non-binding, and that in only certain situations has the Supreme Court ever turned the presumption on the appellee, and that specifically was in a criminal case. And looking at the criminal case of Katiakos v. U.S., the court specifically in that decision said that any attempt to create a generalized presumption turns counter to the harmless error rule. If in this particular situation Mayfield were to be applied and the type 1 notice error was to be instituted, that would run counter to the harmless error rule.
Were there any qualifications?
Well, now, wait. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
Let me make sure that I have the government's position correct here, because it sounds to me like you're saying that the Supreme Court said we could never look at natural effects in determining whether or not there was a potential for harm from a notice error.
Your Honor, no, not exactly. What occurred with the Supreme Court relying heavily on Katiakos, what it said was that there is only, in qualifying its determination, which was raised in the appellant's brief to the court, was that there is in that one situation where the natural effects can be utilized. And what the court was saying is that, which is consistent with the court's duty under 38 U.S.C. Section 7260(1)(b)(2) to review the entire case, that it should be done on a case-by-case basis.
To review it for prejudicial error.
To review it for prejudicial error. Actually, it's they have to do a 5107B analysis and a prejudicial error analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that there are times.
Would
that
Conway be the case that would control that?
Would Conway be the case that
Conway that talks about, you know, this court's duty to do prejudicial error analysis under the statute?
Well, Your Honor, recently, in terms of what the Supreme Court was deciding, mm-hmm. Katiakos was the case that it heavily relied upon in order to come up with the natural effects. And recently in Medrano v. Nicholson, the court discussed what its burdens were in terms of evaluating a case.
But in terms of the general requirement that this court assess prejudicial error, Conway is a key case, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the statute is 7261(b)(2) that ought to be applied?
That's correct. But also,
now, isn't that what Judge Davis did November 13th, 2009? when he looked at the case and specifically said, the court has determined that reconsideration is unwarranted with regard to either of the two bases for remand. Pertinent to the Supreme Court remand, with respect to the VCAA issue, this court evaluated the record as a whole in compliance with 38 U.S.C. 7261b2 and Conway v. Principi. Isn't that exactly what he did?
Your Honor, the Secretary states that due to the specific rationale by the Supreme Court where the we were unable to tell if the burden was changed in that particular case because there is no particular notice within the decision as to who the burden was on in order for us to really garner specifically who or how the court was making its decision. And then looking at what the Supreme Court stated, that it was a mandatory presumption, it did not look as though the court took into consideration those facts within the record, such as the actual knowledge. If the court
the court doesn't have the reasons or bases burden that VA has, does it?
Your Honor, recently, and I have to honestly say that I don't have the specific information, the Federal Circuit looked at a case that was presented to the court and remanded it because they were unable to make a decision as to how the court arrived at its decision.
Is this exercise of our discretion to determine whether or not there is harmless error? What's the standard for review of the exercise of that discretion?
Your Honor, the standard of review for harmless error is de novo review.
Wouldn't it be abuse of discretion?
No, Your Honor. It would not be an abuse of discretion. I would think in terms of the Medrano case, which talked about the court has to look at or should look at the entire record of the proceedings in order to make a determination on harmless error. And by all natural right that it should be done, you can make factual determinations based on that. So
it would be a factual determination by this court that presumably is unreviewable by the Federal Circuit, am I correct?
In terms of Medrano v. Nicholson, the case was sent to the Federal Circuit, and the Federal Circuit affirmed the court's determination in that respect. In order to have a review of the harmless error stat, the harmless error rule, you have to look at the case in terms of a case-by-case basis.
And but even if Judge Davis said in November of 2009 that he evaluated the record as a whole in compliance with 7261b2 and Conway, hasn't he fulfilled his duty?
Your Honor, in terms of that review, the court also should look at what has been developing within the parameters of the position of the Secretary. For instance, at the time that the original decision was made, it was not completely clear as to what was necessary for actual knowledge. That is something that the Secretary believes that the court should take into consideration. Throughout the entire record, we can see, pursuant to Dalton Nicholson, that appellant had the had actual knowledge because through her communications as well as through her actions. And that condition should have been reviewed in the analysis as well.
There's no indication that he didn't do that, is there?
Take into consideration actual knowledge?
Yes. There's no indication in his order of November 2009 that he didn't do that.
Your Honor, as stated previously, at some point the secretary should be able to make a determination as to where the burden was at the time that the case was sent down for reconsideration, as well as if the actual knowledge criteria was applied, in order for the secretary to make a determination as to what the case was decided upon.
Does that mean that in every case where we have a single judge decision and we review for prejudicial error, that either it has to be a panel decision or that we have to write at length about each of the factors that may have influenced that decision?
Your Honor, the secretary would state that in order to comply with the harmless error rule, that the court should make clear as to its case by case, since these cases are determined on a case by case basis, that there should be some information as to how they arrived at the actual decision. So even with a single judge decision, Your Honor, the judge should write how they reviewed that particular case.
Regardless of how they wrote it, I'm assuming your position is that we're a panel and the panel makes a decision de novo, not bound by a single judge decision.
This is correct, Your Honor.
I had another question on a different issue. If you're regard to inextricably intertwined, you said that if we were to remand the right ear, the left ear would be inextricably intertwined. And I'm just curious why, if the rating is correct on the left ear, or it's not shown to be clearly erroneous, and there's no procedural errors, if we were to find that there's no prejudice shown, the record shows that there's no prejudice, what is the inextricably intertwined? You can't get a higher rating with the, even if you're service-connected for the right ear, with the current rating on the left ear, can you?
Well, Your Honor,
and I'm looking at Table 7. If you're looking at a page, I have it as 800. I don't know if I have the current book or not, but 4.86.
Your Honor, in order to for appellant, currently as the record stands, if you're dealing specifically only with the left ear hearing loss, because she's only service-connected for that one particular ear, no matter even if you remanded the claim in order for an additional medical opinion where the appeal period is from April of 98 until June of 2003, the decision of that non-compensable rating would not change. However, in dealing with the right ear hearing loss, Your Honor, if that other ear was found to be service-connected, then the schedule does take on a different meaning in this.
But how does it take on a different meaning if the left ear is rated zero? I mean, if left ear is zero, no matter what you give the right ear, it doesn't change the rating, does it?
Your Honor, there is if the right ear is service-connected.
Service-connected 100%. Give it anything you want, 50%.
And if the hearing in appellant's right ear has a
In the right ear?
In the right ear.
Okay.
There is the potential of the increase in her ear, because now instead of the table demonstrating if she were able to demonstrate that in her better ear, which may be her right ear, that she would have, without the specific numbers, it was a possibility that she could go up in terms of her rating.
Well, show me on the table which one does that. Maybe I'm missing it. But if she had 0% in her left ear, it doesn't affect what she gets for her right ear. And if she had 10% in her left ear, it doesn't affect what she gets in her right ear. So we know she has 0%. If that's upheld.
In terms of your hearing loss, Your Honor, you have to look in order to find out what the designations are. If her designation, which she's never had higher than a 6 in the designation, higher than a 6 in the designation of her ear, the table says in the higher ear, the better ear, which was six, there's a possibility that once her right ear is service-connected, then...
Okay, I see. So she's a six in the left ear?
Correct.
All right, so then it could affect it if the right ear was service-connected? Okay.
Your Honor,
I see.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I see it. Thank you.
Okay.
Counsel, let me just make sure I'm clear about your position with respect to Sanders, the Supreme Court decision. Is it your position that Sanders requires that this court not apply a presumption in analyzing Type 1 notice errors?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And what do you make of the Supreme Court's discussion in Sanders regarding the qualifications under which it issued its opinion? I'll direct your attention to page 1706 and 1707 of the Supreme Court's decision.
Your Honor, in terms of the two qualifications, that's exactly what they are, were qualifications. In that one specific situation where it was a criminal case, and the court said you can discuss the natural facts of it in terms of in that particular case, but it by no means meant that we could, that the court should apply any type of presumption. That would actually undermine what the court stated, that it goes against a system that's complex, mandatory or rigid, or that it creates an unreasonable evidentiary benefit, and it puts VA in the position to say what evidence that why the appellant was not harmed. And we're saying that its decision actually is not inconsistent with its determination for mandatory presumptions. The court in Katiakos, the U.S., specifically discussed in this decision that any attempts to create a generalized presumption runs counter to the harmless error rule. And then when you look at exactly what happened in Katiakos, where they were talking about variances, and then it took in consideration another case, Berger, which had the same type of variance error, and the court said that it has to go, the difference is in the circumstances of the case. Each case has to be reviewed on a case-by-case basis in order to determine if there was some type of prejudicial error.
But the court went on to talk about how certain courts may have special expertise in doing empirical based on their experience with making generalizations. Are you aware of where the natural effects language came from in Mayfield?
The natural, yes, Your Honor, the natural effects language, I believe, Your Honor, came from Katiakos.
That's correct. And Katiakos was a criminal conspiracy case.
Exactly, Your Honor. And in that particular case, the judges, the Supreme Court clearly stated that there could not be any type of generalized presumption. And to say that you cannot substitute judgment for automatic application of a rule. And so what they did in that case, looking at exactly how they made their ruling, they looked at this case specifically.
Are we talking about Katiakos? Can you talk about
yes,
that
we
case?
Are.
Okay, I want to get you back to Sanders, though, and the language in the court's decision in Sanders.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of language here that, as I read it, the Supreme Court makes it clear that it is the Veterans Court, not the Federal Circuit, that sees sufficient, when the court rejected the Federal Circuit's framework, that sees sufficient case-specific raw material in veterans' cases to enable it to make empirically based, non-binding generalizations about natural effects.
Absolutely, Your Honor. The court does have the expertise. In that particular In the Supreme Court's decision, it said that it can make imperative-based generalizations and due to the experience. There were two things that the Supreme Court referred to in its decision. And then it went on and qualified what it was referring to in terms of what can be utilized in terms of the natural effects. And in terms of the natural effects, the court would have to, on a case-by-case basis, pursuant to 7261B, to look at the record of proceedings in total and make a determination based on the circumstances within that case as to whether the natural effects was where appellant was harmed in that particular case. But it did not say that the court could make a mandatory presumption. That would mean that the Supreme Court's entire decision was for naught if they could go about and state that the appellant, I mean, that the burden would be on the appellant. The court has the experience and the knowledge once they review in that specific case whether or not in this situation it would be.
All right, your time is up, but I will let them answer. Are you done? We're done.
Let me ask one more question. What if this court were to say, generally speaking, in a veterans friendly environment, type 1 notice errors are prejudicial. However, that is only one factor to be considered in determining the application of the prejudicial error rule. What would the Secretary's position be with regard to that?
The Secretary would say...
Just a minute. Let me go ahead and add 3 minutes.
Thank you.
The Secretary would state that runs counter to the harmless error rule. And the harmless error rule that the Supreme Court discussed, it specifically states that it can that there can be no mandatory presumptions. In Katiakos, once again, it says that there cannot be, it says any attempt to create a generalized presumption
How then do you reconcile that with the language that Judge Davis has just pointed you to that says that this court is in a position to enable it to make empirically based, non-binding generalizations about natural effects?
The Secretary reconciles that and says that the court should look at each case on a case-by-case basis. And once they look at that particular case, then they can look at to see what the type of error was. And after they review the record and they've gone into a review of the record and they come out to the determination that that there was a type 1 notice error in addition to the other things within the record, they can come up with a decision as to whether or not the appellant was prejudiced.
So that language with regard to generalizations is meaningless. Because you can only generalize as to the specific case.
Absolutely. In Katiakos and in the Supreme Court...
Could you not generalize between service connection and all the ramifications associated with that and all the cases that are increased rating? Isn't that a differentiation?
The court in Katiakos said any attempt, Your Honor, to make a generalization. In a case-by-case basis, the court can look at the decision and make that decision based on empirical data.
Assuming we can go ahead and find that there's prejudice associated with the type 1 notice error, as we did in Mayfield, assuming that were to be upheld, would the same analysis apply to the notice that is required for an increased rating, which is basically a worsening? What would be the factors that would indicate there's a presumption of prejudice because you didn't get told that you had to show it was worsening?
Your Honor, we would state no, it would not be the same, being that, and looking specifically at the Mayfield case, where most cases that are submitted for increased rating claims, appellant is coming already and stating that appellant would like to have an increased rating in terms of their claim. So, therefore, they pretty much already have knowledge of what they need in order to demonstrate an increased rating, especially in this case where the appellant had been going for years in terms of trying to demonstrate increased ratings.
Any other questions? No other questions.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You have 10 minutes. You may proceed.
Actually, Your Honor, I have nothing further unless there are any other questions.
I have one question. Actually, it's a follow-up to the question Judge Castle raised earlier regarding applying our Mayfield analysis to a case for increased rating. Can you either make a case for or against doing that, or why are they different? Why are they similar?
This court has the expertise and the qualifications to make empirically based, non-binding generalizations about the natural effects of certain types of errors. With regards to the increased rating claim and the effect of Mayfield on it, as in Mrs. Simmons' case, Mrs. Simmons was never provided with notice about what it takes to, what information evidence necessary to substantiate that claim, and therefore, because of that, it's a type 1 notice error which should shift the burden over to the Secretary to demonstrate the essential fairness of adjudication.
Is there any major difference because this is an increased ratings case rather than a service connection case? Is there any meaningful difference in how that analysis would apply?
The only difference is now complicated by the decision of Vasquez Flores.
I guess the next logical question is, would you like to elaborate?
Conceivably, Vasquez Flores simply indicates that notice need not be specific and only need to be general. And it's very hard, conceivably, to imagine any person filing a claim for increased compensation without having a very basic understanding that they're asking for increased compensation based on a worsening of their condition or based on a worsening of their circumstances from that condition, for example, total disability rating based on unemployability. But we can be surprised by the types of errors that are made by VA when, for example, a person applying for increased rating is sent information about how to establish service connection in a letter. Surely, it's very difficult to in light of Vasquez Flores, to, unless there's just an absolute error such as that, to indicate that under actual knowledge, if the burden shifts, that a claimant wouldn't have actual knowledge. They need to simply demonstrate that there's a worsening of their condition. That's conceivably Mrs. Simmons' biggest problem. It's her biggest hurdle. Now, there's no doubt she's had numerous examinations. She's had numerous statements of the case. There's no doubt about that. There's no doubt that she's been to many, many examinations and many doctors. The problem, though, is that the complication with Vasquez Flores is it's sort of like putting my hand behind my back and asking you how many fingers am I holding up? And if you're the claimant, you're guessing how many fingers, and the claimant's guessing, but the claimant doesn't have actual knowledge. But again, this goes to Vasquez Flores.
At some point in this litigation, I believe it's correct to say that the Secretary conceded that there was a Type 1 violation. Does that have any binding effect?
I believe it's a finding of fact. When Judge Davis issued his memorandum decisions, I think in discussion with co-counsel, we were discussing findings of fact and conclusions of law and whether or not the Secretary had jurisdiction to appeal certain findings up to the Federal Circuit. For example, it's a finding of fact whether or not there was a Type 1 notice error. Is it a finding of fact? And as you rightly asked, when the court says, take into account the rule of prejudicial error, we don't find that the error is harmless. We find that the error is prejudicial. Is that a finding of fact? Yes, we believe that's a finding of fact, and then that's not reviewable at the Federal Circuit as well. So if that's not reviewable by the Federal Circuit, the only thing that's reviewable at the Federal Circuit is the interpretation of law. Was the Type 1 notice error matrix standard in Mayfield, was that appropriate? And the question, obviously, the Fed Circuit didn't reach it, but the Fed Circuit took Sanders, but this went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court took out the Fed Circuit, but findings of fact, I think the findings of fact still stand.
The critical paragraph here that I think everything revolves around is this one that starts with, it is the Veterans Court, not the Federal Circuit. And you quoted the essence of that as you started your rebuttal. And yet, the way I read some of your pleadings, you argue that there is, or that this court has, the authority to establish a presumption that a type 1 error is prejudicial. Am I misunderstanding what you're saying? Because I have trouble reconciling that with the portion of that paragraph that says it's okay for us to establish non-binding generalizations.
It's a mouthful. Empirically based, non-binding generalizations about the natural effects of certain types of errors causing prejudice. This court clearly has the expertise. 15,000 appeals in its lifetime, nearly 3,000 appeals every year. The Supreme Court went out of its way to say this court sees the bulk of veterans' cases and has that expertise, clearly, to make these empirically based, non-binding generalizations, non-binding, but empirically based non-binding generalizations about the natural effects of certain types of errors. And this court certainly has that expertise to do that, not only for notice errors, but other types of errors, for example, for reasons or bases.
So you would read non-binding generalizations as rebuttable presumption, perhaps?
Absolutely. And the Secretary certainly can demonstrate the essential fairness of the adjudication by any means that the court deems appropriate. I have nothing further. Thank you very much.
Well, on that, the case will be submitted. Come down and greet counsel.
All rise.
Nice to meet you, Justice.